Denny, what happened to the music? Okay. Welcome, everybody, to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts, along with noted crime consultants and attorneys, often featured on the popular news programs, for families of violent crime to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there, on top of the crime, at the top of their game. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You can call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat room right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you're a friend or you're a family member, and this is very important because a lot of times in these cases, people do not know where to turn. You know, we have Monica from the Q Center who comes and deals and handles families of missing persons and loved ones. But where does somebody go when there is no justice? Through the last couple of years, this show has had the tremendous ability to deal and assist families and find answers and solutions in their cases. And this is what we're going to continue with doing. But if you have a case and you just don't know where you should go, if you're not happy with the outcome of the death determination in your loved one, or if you'd like information on how you can assist in your own case in finding answers, a cold case, a missing loved one, like I said, then please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
In 2000, Michael Callahan was the newly promoted investigations commander over a 9-county area in East Central Illinois. His first assignment was to review the 14-year-old murder of a young newlywed couple, Dyke and Karen Rhodes. They would change his life forever, shattering his faith in the department he had loved and had dedicated his life to. Rumblings from the downstate Illinois Innocence Project, the Center on Wrongful Convictions at Northwestern University, and an impending show on CBS's 48 Hours, were that two men had been wrongfully convicted for these murders. This attention drew deep concern from the corrupt administration of Governor George Ryan and the politically compromised command of the Illinois State Police. During his career, Lieutenant Callahan had helped put more than his fair share of criminals behind bars, but little did he know that the biggest adversaries he would ever face were those within his own department. And Michael, welcome to CrimeWire.
Thank you, Denny. It's an honor to be on your show. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, Denny, look at this. You know, we both read the book, and I'm from Illinois. So Denny, when you were reading this book, I'm kind of not trying to interview you, but your take on this, I think, is really important before we ask Michael any questions, because it is really, it's like something out of something that you don't think is true.
If you read that in a fiction book, you wouldn't think that much of it. You just think, well, somebody with a vivid imagination, you know, trying to make, maybe he's got a thing against cops, he's trying to make them look bad. But Susan, you and I both know from our previous CrimeWire and other experiences, and we usually hear these stories from the family of a deceased person, the family of someone who's been convicted, perhaps, that the police, as much as we would like to think they are all almost godlike figures, that's not true. And to hear it, though, or read about it from the inside, not from somebody who may have an axe to grind or somebody who might have sour grapes, but somebody who was in it, somebody who was part of a police force and encountered this situation, is just, it's almost stunning. You know,
No, I mean, for our listeners, about the fact that this man basically put up his badge and his life for the protection of First Amendments, which is what we're going to get to. But for, you know, and it's funny, like I said, I'm from Illinois, and I know that a lot of people will be listening to this. And I know that they are very familiar with me, and I am here to tell them, as I told them on a show a couple weeks ago, the copper-toned suntan girl that would bite up on the poster, that we all remember when she was burned too much and the dog was biting at the underwear? That's what I'm doing now in Illinois with O'Callaghan and this book and this case, because you still have unsolved homicides here, unsolved, and you still have corruption, and somebody's covering up. And I think that, you know, we're going to get to that, but that's what's so interesting about, you know, Michael goes above and beyond. I'm not meaning to talk as though he's not here, but we're not going to get to that part of it once we jump into this book, because it is amazing, and so is he.
Well, you know, Susan, I got to say, and I think Michael, well, I don't want to speak for him, but he might agree with me on this. You probably can go to most police departments throughout the country now and in the past, and if you talk to certain officers, they would always know little things that had happened. You know, you can call it the thin blue line or whatever you want to call it, but where people don't come forward and speak out. It could be just stuff where maybe somebody was driving a patrol car while maybe they were under the influence or something. I mean, things like this happen. But here we're talking not about maybe something that would result in disciplinary action for a violation of rules, but people going to prison for something they didn't do for life. I mean, it doesn't get much more serious than this, and I really appreciate and want to congratulate Michael for having the courage, because this probably was not all that easy a thing to do, again, going against the department that you served and loved. And I don't know how many more officers are out there that might know things similar to this, but don't come forward. But I certainly want to commend Michael for doing what he did to bring this to light.
Yes, and I think that the storyline of these individuals is something that, again, we don't see very often. And you know, the newlyweds, Dyke and Karen Rhodes, on July 6, 1986, were found murdered in their bedroom, stabbed over 50 times. They were kind of two local barflies, Randy Stidle and Herb Whitlock, convicted. They're convicted of murders in June of 87, and two unbelievable eyewitnesses, basically the town drunk and a self-admitted drug addict with alcoholic, you know, past and history, mental illness, they're the state's main witnesses, aren't they, Michael?
They're not only the state's main eyewitnesses, but the problem, they both claim to be eyewitnesses at the murder scene at the exact same time, yet they never see each other.
Why don't you go into what happens on for the listeners on July 6, 1986, what takes place?
Well, in the morning of July 6, 1986, the fire department was called to the Rhodes residence. And when the firemen were able to force their way into the house and make their way upstairs, they found the couple had been brutally stabbed over a total of 54 times. And they removed the bodies immediately. There had been a fire set, a gasoline-fueled arson, to cover up the crime. Obviously, when they removed the bodies, they disturbed a lot of the crime scene. But an investigation ensued, and then, like you said, less than a year later, two men were arrested on a very weak motive from the state of Illinois.
Dan?
Well, Randy Stidle was subsequently convicted and sentenced to the death penalty, and Herb Whitlock was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. Then 14 years later, I was a newly appointed lieutenant in the Illinois State Police. I had transferred from the Chicago area downstate, and the Innocence Project had claimed that they had new information saying the two men were innocent. There was also a pending show on 48 Hours, which caused a lot of concern in the George Ryan administration and the State Police Upper Command. And I was George Ryan was one of our past governors. We've had two governors in a row. Unfortunately, both convicted for corruption and racketeering, George Ryan in 2006, and then Rod Blagojevich, I think, has been on national news just recently, was convicted and should start his prison term in about 2 days, I believe.
So we've had a bad luck with governors in the state of Illinois, which is three or four, it's four, isn't it? Four governors of in Illinois have been convicted.
Four of our last seven. So it's not a very good track record.
No. Why don't you please set it up for us. Tell us about Karen. Tell us about, because this plays a very important part in this unsolved homicide.
You know, Karen and Dyke were just married in March of 1986, so they were young newlyweds. When they were murdered, they were only into their marriage about 3.5 months. They were depicted by everyone as the all-American couple. Karen was considered beautiful, hardworking. She was well-liked, very religious.
Where did
very
Karen
much
work?
She worked at Bob Morgan, Inc., a pet food additive company.
A pet? Wait, stop right there. Denny, what do you hear when you hear pet food additive? Because you work with the mob cases. That's why this is very interesting.
Yeah. Well, it opens up some areas certainly to think about here. It's possible something that we've run across on occasion looking at some organized crime stuff. I don't want to give away too much, but it raises some flags.
Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, we're still early in the story. And then Dyke Rhodes was, you know, very handsome, very athletic, again, well-liked in the community, local softball player. But he did admit to, prior to meeting Karen, he was termed probably an occasional partier, you know, like to smoke the occasional joint. But everybody knew that once he married Karen, even as all the friends, his best friends interviewed, said that he distanced himself from any type of that lifestyle because Karen was so adamant against alcohol and drugs that, you know, he totally changed. Both were very happy at the time of their murders. The state really had no motive until the first eyewitness showed up. There was no physical evidence in this case linking anyone to the crime. So the whole town of Paradise was an utter shock over this.
How many people are in the town, Michael? How many people are in the town that we're talking about?
Paradise, Illinois is about 3.5 hours south of Chicago, about 1.5 hours west of Indianapolis. It's on the Illinois-Indiana border. It's a small town of about 9,000 people. Many of its residents would refer to Paris Bow as Little Chicago, and it had its connections to, you know, motorcycle gangs and to the old pizza connection case out of New York, and there was, we would come to find as we looked into this case, a lot of unsolved homicides in that little town. So it did have a little bit of a sinister background.
And then what is the report of what happens to these two individuals? What is there a fire? Are they, how do they know that they're stabbed that many times? What's the layout or the condition of the crime scene when officers arrive from the reports that you read?
Well, again, as I said, the firemen removed the bodies immediately. The autopsy showed that Dyke Rhodes was 28 years old, but he was stabbed 28 times. There, of those 28 stab wounds, only one wound was determined a fatal blow. The other 27 wounds were an inch to an inch and a half in depth. And most of those wounds, over half, were to his back, so which meant he was probably lying on his stomach asleep when the attacks occurred. Karen was 25 years old, and she suffered 26 stab wounds. Again, only two of those wounds were determined to be death blows to the heart. The other 24 wounds, an inch to an inch and a half in depth, which causes a lot of speculation in itself. But unlike Dyke, she also had defense wounds to her arm and wrist, which meant she probably saw and fought with her killer or killers.
Could she have been
she
tortured,
also,
perhaps? Was it more? Was her more her death, from what the report said, was it more torture?
You know, that was one of our speculations. You know, she had obviously talked prior to her murder. She had expressed to family members a lot of concerns with things she'd seen at work, a lot of incidents. obviously, investigators felt that was somewhat of a motive, but they still failed to investigate that motive. But the fact that she had voiced to her mother herself, she said, "I saw things I shouldn't have seen at work," and one of our speculations was she tortured to find out who she had told about what she had seen at work? So obviously that was a motive that we looked into that was overlooked in the original investigation.
Danny?
Yeah, you know, Michael, I can't help but wonder, trying to just put myself in your position for a minute. When you got this assignment to review this case, at that point, did you think it was just going to be kind of a you know, routine piece of cake thing? Did you foresee any chance of finding what you found here?
You know, you have to remember my mindset. I came from the Chicago area. I'm very proud of the Illinois State Police, and I still am. I mean, this is an example of just a few that can make a whole department look bad. But, you know, when I first got this assignment, I was told, hey, you can rubber stamp this case. Of course we have the right guys. And I didn't disagree. I mean, my mindset was, of course, we're the Illinois State Police. We don't make mistakes. And my God, we would never be a part of putting innocent men in prison. So the thought never crossed my mind that we hadn't got the right guys. But, you know, my wife would tell you, I started reading some of the documentation the Innocence Project turned over, and then I read our own state police case file, and I would stay up till 2, 3 in the morning, and I would start nudging my wife and say, oh, my God, listen to this. And,
can you explain, please, Michael, what is the Innocence Project for the listeners?
Well, there's several Innocence Projects throughout the United States, and the Innocence Project usually takes on cases of those that have received the death penalty, or sometimes in other instances, just life in prison, but they will take on people that they feel are wrongfully convicted, and then they will provide them, you know, a pro bono attorney service. Private investigators will come forward and actually investigate the case, and then they'll obviously go through the court system to try and see that the men are freed, which would eventually happen in this case. So.
Okay.
But just a very egregious case. As I read through the case file, I was not only ashamed at the lack of professionalism by my own in this case, but there were so many red flags in this case. I became convinced that there had been evidence withheld that showed these guys were innocent, and I was actually very suspicious of my own, like I said, for wrongdoing in this case. And we could probably talk for hours about some of the complexities.
In addition to what you found when you were reviewing the files, you also got some, again, we'll say red flags from contacts that were made by fellow police officers.
You know, before I
expressing concern about your review.
You know, and that was one of the first red flags. I got a call from the supervisor that had supervised the Rhodes homicide investigation, and his words when he found out I was reviewing this case. Now, you have to understand, I'm reviewing it 14 years after the fact. And his concern was that he goes, please don't make us old-timers look bad. That was obviously a shock to me because as far as I was concerned, as far as the law was concerned in the state, they had solved a very heinous and brutal homicide of a young couple, and they had convicted two men, putting one on death row. It doesn't get much more final than that. And not 30 minutes after I hung up the phone with the supervisor, the case agent himself calls me up and tells me, asks me not to ruin his reputation and that he's not a dirty cop. Very alarming to have your own people within your department tell you. I mean, obviously I was very suspicious of those type of phone calls, and it wasn't just the words, it was just the actual concern in their voices that alarmed me.
Alarmed you because they were, do you think that, tell me what you learned about Karen. Tell me what you learned, because, you know, this house wasn't next door to somebody else's, and how quickly that night in the report does it say that the fireman had come to put the fire? Do you remember?
Well, the fireman showed up in the early morning hours, but there was several incidents that she had claimed, and again, it goes into a lot of detail, complexities about all the motives that were ignored in this case, but there's actually no motive established by the investigators for the first 2.5 months of this after the crime and the investigation begins. And 2.5 months later, the town drunk appears, and he is hauled into the police department one night by the lead detective in this case and the chief of police, who say they were just patrolling the midnight hour in Paris. And as they see the stumbling Daryl Harrington, the eyewitness, you know, walking down the street, they decide to give him a ride home. And, of course, when he gets in the back of the squad car, he looks at the two officers and says, just don't ask me about the murders. And, of course, you know, they're good cops, so they decide they better ask him. And they take the intoxicated man to the police department. This is on a Friday, September 19th, almost 2.5 months after the murders. And during that interview, he tells them two men named Jim and Ed killed Dyke and Karen Rhodes. The problem is the police never document pulling in Harrington that night, never document that he names the murderers of Jim and Ed. In fact, they don't document anything. And the very next morning, after grilling the man till about 6 in the morning, they take him to the Charleston Motor Inn about 20 miles away, where they now admit they first supplied the town drunk with a fifth of whiskey and a six-pack of beer, and continued to feed him alcohol until Sunday, when he was taken to the chief's house. And then we see the first documented interview 2 days later on September 21st, and he changes the names from Jim and Ed, who are never mentioned in the report, to Randy Steidel and Herb Whitlock as the murders of Dyke and Karen.
I can't remember, is in 1986, was there the 911 system in place yet or no?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, so there's no documentation as to who called in the call, how they knew, because obviously somebody wanted the house to burn down.
Well, when the house was set on fire, neighbors had heard screams prior to the house being set on fire. And then two of the neighbors, a neighbor, man and woman, both looked out their window and ran. And they would try to get into the Rhodes house, obviously, to save the couple. And when they found all the doors locked, the woman ran and called the fire department. And that's when we see the fire department respond at 4:39 a.m.
Was the fire set in one area, a bunch of areas? Did they determine whether it was gasoline?
It was gasoline, and it looks like it was probably set in the kitchen area.
And where wasn't the bedrooms upstairs?
The bedrooms were upstairs.
So they
and there was mostly
the house
upstairs. There was a lot of smoke damage, soot damage, that type of thing.
So somebody expected to start the fire at the base, so it would just all kind of torch up.
Yes. Yeah, which would have covered up the crime, but, you know, as we were told later, certain people made statements that the house just wouldn't burn right. Excuse me.
That's people who are, you know, I mean, that's amazing. And then when...
Well, and then as you look through the case file, obviously when I began reviewing this case, you know, I the polygraph examiner that was in the original investigation came to my office, and we started talking, and he told me how he had polygraphed Daryl Harrington, the first eyewitness, and he had ruled that not only was he purposely misleading police, that he was lying, and that he suggested that they don't use the man as a witness at all, but definitely needed a second polygraph. And in fact, it was kind of interesting. One of the questions on the polygraph, the police actually admit that he had lied to them, because they actually ask him this question on the polygraph. It says, besides the first time you talked with police, did you make any other false statements about this case? So you think about that. The police are actually acknowledging he lied to them in his first statements to the police. And actually he answered no to this question and was found untruthful to that question. So obviously that this man's credibility was shot from day one, but they still continue to use him as an eyewitness. And they went before a grand jury and testified he was a credible witness.
And then what about the other person that they had? You know, it was because it just wasn't him. And so that's what the state bases their case on, these two people?
Yeah, I mean, there was even correspondence in 1987, 4 months after Harrington had come forward, there was correspondence with the FBI who had offered to profile the suspects in the case. And there was even documentation by the investigators saying that Daryl Harrington was a very poor witness. They couldn't corroborate anything he said, and they had no probable cause to arrest Steidel or Whitlock based on his statements. Yet, 3 weeks later, they arrested both of those men based on telling a grand jury that he was a credible witness. And then, 7.5 months after the murders, we have the second eyewitness come forward, who, like Harrington, is an alcoholic, who, like Harrington, you know, has a history of mental health issues, who, like Harrington, has a criminal history. He has a criminal history for domestic violence and deceptive practice, and she has a very violent criminal history for a plethora of things. And not only that, but she's in and out of mental health facilities most of her adult life, so she's also mentally unstable. And what was shocking to me, both eyewitnesses in the reports to the police, they talk about how Harrington says that he drank 12 straight hours with the two men the night before the murders, the evening before the murders. Reinbold says she drank with the men the evening before the murders, yet they never ever see each other or mention each other being at those bars with those two men. And Harrington admits to passing out several times throughout the night. He's so drunk. And Reinbold says that she drank 18 beers and smoked three joints and popped a half a bottle of codeine pills that night. So obviously their statements were very unbelievable and not credible just from those statements.
And how long?
Excuse me.
Yeah, I mean, Denny, I mean, this, we're not even halfway through this. I mean, this
yeah,
is in a small
on just
area.
A few, I'm just talking on a few of the red flags. I mean, there was just so many other red flags. There was letters we intercepted from the lead detective, Jim Parrish, to Debbie Reinbold in prison. Both eyewitnesses recanted their trial testimony and then would recant those recantations after we found that the police officers and the prosecutor made trips to visit Reinbold and Dwight, or they would visit Harrington. And there was basically, I like to call them sympathy love letters from Parrish to Reinbold in prison. And then years later, we would even have a witness come forward say that the lead detective, Parrish, was having a sexual relationship with Reinbold. And he passed the polygraph when he took that. So there's a lot of perversions.
These two men are, by the time you get the case, they're already in, they're tried and sentenced and thrown away. Key gone. Goodbye. They're on death row. And
yeah, Randy had several appeals denied at the state level. He used to tell me how he would sit there and have an appeal denied, and then a guard would walk by and slip him a piece of paper with a new execution date, and he would just, you know, curl up in a fetal ball, and he felt so helpless. Finally, he made it to the federal level.
You get this case reopened because you could get demoted and less than death duty, and people are not thinking very nice of you, and you just say, you know what, I'm going to open this case up.
Well, what happened is I did a review, and my review submitted to the upper command of the Illinois State Police. I told them that neither man was proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I had suspicions of wrongdoing in your full investigation, and that definitely evidence had been withheld that showed these two men were innocent, which is exculpatory evidence.
There was nothing we should point out, too, that there was no evidence there against the guys that they arrested for the murder.
No, any physical evidence that the prosecutor used was evidence that was fabricated evidence supplied by the eyewitnesses, and it was used solely to show that the eyewitnesses by the prosecution were at the scene. But not only was that evidence scientifically picked apart, it was picked apart by their own testimony, and then in their recantations, they all admitted that the police manipulated or coerced them into saying those things.
Tell us where Karen worked. What was her job, her duties?
She was a secretary/quality control manager at the pet food additive place. Dyke was, at the time, he had worked for Kimlon, but he was out of work. But he was allegedly supposed to start working the Monday after he was murdered at Edgar Electric.
How long had Karen worked at this place? What was her responsibilities? Was she just a clerk? Was she somebody that was trusted? Was she somebody that handled day-to-day operations?
No, she was in quality control, so she was a very trusted employee, and she was well-liked. Her boss, when he was interviewed, said that, she was an exceptional employee, and she had a lot of responsibilities. And as time goes on, we find that the detectives had written reports. There was motives that were ignored, where she had talked about concerns that she had, there was talk of drugs she had witnessed. There was an incident one night where she went into work in the evening, and her boss told her that he was leaving for Chicago. And after he left, she got a phone call, and when she advised the caller on the other end that her boss was on the way to Chicago. He said, well, this is Chicago calling, go get him. I need to talk to him. As she walked out, hello?
Yes.
As she walked out into the parking lot, she observed her boss and another employee loading machine guns and a briefcase of money into the back of his car.
Hold on a moment. Denny, you're a former police officer. When you hear that, so what? This isn't a food additive company, is it, any longer?
No, things have changed here. Machine guns and a briefcase full of money. Yeah.
Well, not just that. The dog food company was actually next door to a pizza parlor where the owner of that pizza parlor was 4 years or was later con- or actually in 1984 was convicted in the infamous Pizza Connection case out of New York, which involved the Sicilian Mafia and the five families in New York.
So this had connections to New York then, Denny. It was the organized crime.
There was the potential, and there was motives. Yeah, there was definitely this.
Michael, can I ask you a question? I just want to make sure I'm correct here. Okay, the Harrington is staggering down the street one night. He's picked up, going to be given a ride home. He mentions don't ask me about the murder. He's kept for a couple of days in a motel, given some booze and so forth. And then he goes on record for the first recorded documented interview, and the names Ed and Jim or whatever he'd initially given the officers when they picked him up to give him a ride is now changed to Sadell, Seidel, and Whitlock.
Right.
Am I correct on that? That's what happened. Okay.
Except for Jim and Ed were
Whitlock
never ever mentioned in a report.
Oh, they were never mentioned at all. Okay.
No, they weren't mentioned at all.
So they were never even mentioned at all.
No, no mention was ever made of Harrington talking about two men named Jim and Ed committing the murders of Dyke and Karen. It only appeared because the polygraph examiner had been told this by the investigators, and he put it in his notes. And then obviously we discovered the polygraph exam, which Harrington fails miserably. And then then we find out that polygraph is never disclosed to Seidel or Whitlock's defense attorneys.
Now, once Seidel and Whitlock got into the picture through Harrington, were they known to the police? I mean, what were they all about?
You know, Randy and Herb were, known as barflies. They liked to go to the bars and drink, and Randy and Herb both were known to be, they like their women and they like to drink. And Randy would admit that, and that was mostly, he had a few scrapes where he'd get in bar fights. And that was basically his criminal history, a few bar fights. As far as Herb, I think he had one arrest for cocaine, and it was like a gram, and, he alleged that was a setup from the state's attorney's office, so which we can get into later. But eventually the state's motive would be a drug deal gone bad between Dyke Rhodes and these two men, and that was the motive that would end up getting them convicted. Although it's never established what type of drug deal it was, what it was over, how much money. I mean, there is... that motive is really never, ever established. It's just implied and inferred by the state.
So Seidel and Whitlock then were not real hardcore criminals, I mean, with extensive criminal records or assaults with a deadly weapon.
Not at all. In fact, the jury would hold in Whitlock's case, they felt like he was so little and small that he couldn't have killed either person. And his trial was actually on a 3-day weekend. It came up on a Friday, Memorial Day weekend, and the jury, there's newspaper articles about it, but the jury said, we don't think he killed either person, but they didn't want to be sequestered for the 3-day weekend, so they said, well, find him guilty of killing one and not the other. So
nice compromise.
Yeah, that's a nice, not a nice compromise for her, but I guess it saved him the death penalty, so which the prosecutor was seeking. Now, what we also find out is that weeks before the Rhodes murders, Randy's, because people will often ask me, why out of the 9,000 residents in Paris, Illinois, was it Randy and Herb? But we find out that weeks before the murders of Dyke and Karen, Randy and Herb actually went to the FBI in Danville, Illinois, talked to an agent named Ken Temples to report corruption, personal drug use, protection of gambling and drug trafficking by the state's attorney, the very state's attorney who would end up prosecuting them, withholding evidence and putting them in prison.
Did they know that at the time?
Did they know what? That he was
That this information had come forth and that the prosecuting state's attorney had his hand very dirtied.
Well, actually, like I said, Randy and Herb went to the FBI. And
okay.
In fact, the FBI is going to later say, you know what, I thought it was kind of strange that here's these two guys and they come to turn in the state's attorney for corruption and drug trafficking, and then he ends up prosecuting them for a double murder that happens, you know, 3 or 4 weeks later. So
why didn't somebody, the FBI agent, did he note that? Did he step up? Did he try to speak? Did you ever talk to him?
Well, you know what, he did. There was reports written, and in fact, Randy would again ask to speak with the FBI right before his trial, and in it he got a little bit more explicit, and you know, he talked about how, you know, Karen Rhodes' boss was being protected by the state's attorney, and that Harrington was being paid by this, you know, Karen Rhodes' boss to set them up. And this was all documented in an FBI report, but it went no further by the FBI.
So was Rhodes' boss a political sponsor of the state's attorney?
Well, we would come to find out he wasn't just he was a big campaign contributor to a lot of politicians in the state of Illinois. One of the main people was Governor George Ryan at the time, who would later be obviously convicted for corruption and racketeering in the state of Illinois and sentenced to 6.5 years in federal prison. But, you know, you could speculate after I divulged this information to the upper command of the state police, I would be brought in and told this case was too politically sensitive to investigate. So, you know, you can speculate why I was told this case was too politically sensitive. I would say that it could be several reasons. One was this, that Governor Ryan, who was already under federal investigation, it wouldn't look good if a suspect in a homicide was one of his big campaign contributors. And then obviously the image of the Illinois State Police wouldn't be look too good if some of our own were part of helping to railroad this man into prison. And then obviously if these two men are wrongfully convicted, there's going to be expensive civil suits. So
Don't listen very well. So in April of 2001 to August, it's like you turn a deaf ear, and you go in and start looking at the homicide anyway, and you gather more information and piss off more people.
And you know, it wasn't just me. I mean, there was a sergeant, a major. I had a lot of support from fellow state police officers that just felt this was an egregious case, and we just couldn't let it lie. We also felt very helpless what to do. But as you continued to look at this, there was just more and more egregious information that came out.
But see, Michael, I don't agree. Because they let you stick your neck out. These people didn't stand up with you. They didn't. They let you be the Lone Ranger. And they might have shook their head, yes, but if it came to their pension and their badges at the time, they would not have come forward like you did.
Well, I have to disagree with you there, because you know what? Each and every one of them stood up and testified when I filed a civil rights First Amendment lawsuit.
But Michael,
every
that was after.
People.
Michael, I'm talking about while they were on the jobs, while you were still there. It's different when they're subpoenaed and they come in. That's different.
They weren't subpoenaed.
In
they
the
came
heat of this.
The...
In the heat of this. I'm just saying that it was very, it's very hindsight, because they see that you had something. It's not a bashing of them. And it's not a criticism. I'm saying that you were the only one that was out there publicly, really out there. That's what I meant. Not anything against them.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I guess I know the suffering that they went through, like me. Those people stood by my side, and they felt just as helpless as I did, and they were willing to put their necks out, and many of them suffered retaliation. You have to understand, I retired 2 weeks before my jury trial against the State Police Upper Command for violating my First Amendment rights. A lot of these people still had long careers to go, and they still stood up and testified and told the truth. And they went to every time that I tried to get this case reopened, they were standing beside me fighting to get it reopened too. I probably was the most vocal of the group.
That's what I meant. I mean, I kept
the fight going, but you know, I mean, you know, Major Edie Casella, I mean, they removed her from a command. They told her, "Hey, you have a communication problem. You don't know how to take no for an answer." They put her in a cubicle behind a desk with no phone in Springfield, Illinois, and with no job.
But you should explain to it in September of 2003. You file a First Amendment lawsuit against the Illinois State Police for retaliation and violating your freedom of speech and speaking on this matter which was a public concern. And then,
well, what happened in 2003? I finally, again with the support from an FBI agent and his supervisors, with support from State Police, I went to our internal investigations to report my commanders for impeding a criminal investigation, that they had turned a blind eye to this, and innocent men in prison and the real killers remaining. You know, it's an unsolved homicide. And I would learn that before I left the city limits of Springfield, my internal investigations told my commanders, leaked it back to them, that I had turned them in. And it would I that was retaliated against. There were no whistleblower calls to protect me, and that's when I filed a First Amendment lawsuit.
What happens to Herb Whitlock?
Well, it was in 2004, actually in 2003, the day after I was retaliated against and removed from investigations and basically told to keep my mouth shut, a federal judge, Michael McCuskey, ordered the state of Illinois to retry Randy Steidel or free him because the original jury had not heard the truth. This is something I've been telling my command for over 3 years. And then 4 years later, because Herb Whitlock was still in the state courts, he finally, the 4th District Appellate Court, ruled the same thing for him, that the state had, you know, basically violated the United States Constitution and Brady violations and withheld evidence favorable to his defense. And both men were freed. Randy was freed after 17 years.
Just like
prison.
That. Just like that. They were let go. They didn't say they were sorry, nothing. And they had nothing against their record then, did they?
Well, they were exonerated, but they haven't been pardoned because they filed very expensive civil lawsuits against the state. So they would remain targets of the state, and the state would continue to say they're suspects, but the state has never chosen to retry them. And trust me, it's even more shameful, some of the stuff that the Illinois State Police has tried to railroad those guys back in since. But since then, now the state police has settled with Randy Steidel. Herb Whitlock is a little bit more stubborn and refuses to settle with him. I think he wants to have his day in court.
He deserves it. These two men were, you know, thrown away without, I mean, they were very young. They had their whole lives ahead of them.
They lost a third
away.
Of their lives. Yeah.
That's right. And over what? What was the purpose? What was the point of this cover-up that just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger? And you, sir, when you're awarded an award because of your work, because of, from the Innocence Project, for these two men having their freedom, and this book.
Well, I guess the big question to me still remains is why? Why was this young couple murdered, and why does the state refuse to investigate any of the other motives that were established? And those are questions that, you know, I guess they'll have to be answered one day, maybe in a civil trial, but...
it's still,
you know, to me, that's the most egregious thing. I mean, there's a lot of victims in this case, and none greater than Dyke and Karen Rhodes. I mean, they're still 6 feet under the ground, but with no justice.
Is this case still cold on the books? Does it still exist on the books?
In the Illinois State Police, you can't close an unsolved homicide. So obviously, if it's not solved, it remains open. But at this point, it's placed on a 365-day case file status, which means it sits on a shelf, and one day a year, a captain picks up the file and says, you know, case is unsolved, remains open. So there is nobody
investigating. So it's a dust collector, basically. It makes good fireplace starter.
Right.
Because they're not going to do anything with it.
And it has for several years now. I mean, it's been sitting on a shelf for several years.
Are there any family members left from either one of them that continue to fight, or are they all deceased?
No, there's several family members left. And you know, early on when I took on this investigation, I met with some of the Rhodes family members. And you know, interestingly, they didn't believe the state's version of the truth either. In fact, they came to us. I still remember the pained look in their faces. They said, we don't believe the state's case. We don't believe what McFatridge said. And both sides, Karen and Dyke's family members, have said that. They were very upset about the fact that they made this out to be a drug deal between Dyke and the two men when they knew that wasn't true. So they wanted this case reopened. They wanted it reinvestigated. So, you know, put yourself in their shoes right now. Who do they have to turn to? Who do they have to trust?
Now, sir, you are before court yourself again, aren't you? This hasn't ended. This continues. Why don't you explain?
Oh, well, you know, obviously these men have, you know, filed civil lawsuits. So in the
against
interim,
you.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we go back to the, you know, the First Amendment issue, if you like. I filed a First Amendment lawsuit against the Illinois State Police Upper Command. At the time, you know, government employees had freedom of speech or First Amendment protections if they spoke out on a matter of public concern. We went to trial, and I won a two-week federal jury trial, and the federal judge concurred that I had spoken out on a matter of public concern. In fact, he quoted, obviously, innocent men in prison ignored and the real killers free, and the fact that my internal investigations had refused to investigate serious criminal allegations against my command, that should be a matter of public concern for everybody. I was awarded a pretty hefty judgment, and then 2 years later, or actually, yeah, 1 year later, the United States Supreme Court passed a new law which suppressed freedom of speech for government employees.
Explain that.
Well, it was a ruling in a case out of the Ninth Circuit out of California, Garcetti versus Ceballos, and basically the Supreme Court ruled when public employees make statements pursuant to their official duties, they are not speaking as citizens for First Amendment purposes, and the Constitution does not insulate their communications from employer discipline. So basically it says that if you're a police officer and you're at work while on the job and you see a crime or you see government corruption, you don't have the protection of the First Amendment to speak out. With no whistleblower laws to protect you in the state of Illinois, my last hope was the First Amendment to speak out about this. And in 2008, actually about a few months after Herb Whitlock won his freedom, the United States Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and this was their actual ruling, they said Mr. Callahan spoke not as a citizen, but as a public employee, and that speech is not entitled to protection by the First Amendment. And my case was reversed, which I think that should be very frightening for everybody because, you know, Denny, you'll probably agree with me. I mean, not once for my 25 years of service, every time I put my gun and badge on, and I don't think there's any cop out there that when they put their gun and badge on, they don't think that they're not a United States citizen. And it's very frightening because today, you know, police officers, you know, we have the power to take away a life, but not the freedom of speech to speak out if it's done unjustly. And that's not just for police officers. That's for school teachers or any type of government employee at a local, county, state, or federal level.
But you also have somebody else is suing you for something. What is that?
My book and I were actually, we had a lawsuit filed. Again, I talk about the connections to the Pizza Connection case to Paris, Illinois, and the fact that Joe Vitale was arrested in 1984 and convicted in 1987 for his involvement.
Is Joe Vitale a mobster?
He was indicted and tried and found guilty of being a faction of the Sicilian Mafia.
And what pray
tell? Along
tell
with his uncle, who was Gaetano Buonaparte, who at one time was the former head of the Sicilian Mafia and Senesi crime family, and several other relatives out of Illinois that were nephews to Gaetano Buonaparte.
I hate to admit that I dated a Senesi years ago. I don't. But I did, because he owned this comedy club. I did. Denny, don't laugh. But what's not funny is that this person has a lawsuit against you now because you wrote this book.
Well, there's been several attacks, you know, on my family and I. I mean, you know, we found out early on that, you know, when after Randy and Herb filed, you know, wrongful civil rights violation suits against the state police, you know, there was public relations people hired that worked with the highly paid, you know, Chicago attorneys to, there's actually emails that we have now intercepted that were turned over.
I don't think
we
want to talk about that, Michael.
No,
we're building a lot of things with this. And again, I'd be happy.
Well, one of their strategies was to bait me into a lawsuit, and since I have been sued for defamation by the son of Joe Vitale.
I would love to invite him. You know, I do a lot of different radio shows besides this one. I'd love to have Mr. Vitale on as a guest, and whomever else.
Well, you know what? We're trying to get him to be deposed, but his attorneys don't want it. They're trying to fight it. So, I'm willing to be deposed, and yet he doesn't want to be. So I have a lot of documents I'd like to go over with him.
I'm sure that you'll have to be able to do that in court. And isn't it sad, Denny? Denny, this is like you writing, in a sense, a book with a few of the people that you've written them with. You've stood up. You're talking about crimes. You're talking about cases. And I just can't believe that these people would be suing him, Denny.
It is a lot, because a lot of times once they open the door, you know, and start a court action, then they, of course, can be deposed and so on and so forth, and discovery, and you'd think that maybe they just want to let a sleeping dog lie. But, I'd like to ask, if I could, a couple of questions just for my own information.
Sure.
In the state police, at least as it was back, now I want to go back, not to your review, but to the initial investigation of the homicide.
Yes.
How was the structure of the state police, at least at that point, how many supervisors or how many reviews or how many hands would an investigator's reports or have to go through where people had to kind of sign off, you know, review what had been done and then make recommendations or whatever? Was there such a process where there would be some supervisory overview of what the investigators were doing and what their information was and what their case consisted of?
Oh, yeah, and it depends on what part of the case you're in. you know, obviously you have a case agent that's assigned to an investigation. In this case, it was a sergeant, and he reported to a master sergeant, which was usually designated to be over a squad, and then you would have an actual zone commander, which would be probably a lieutenant like myself. And if all supervisors are supposed to review and be active participants in any investigation, I certainly was. You know, two or three heads, or four or five heads, or 10 heads are better than one. So obviously, it's a team effort. So this, you know, case agent would have had his reports reviewed by supervisors, and actually some of the decisions would have had to go all the way to Springfield. For instance, we found in the case file, which was very egregious to myself, because you have to understand the second eyewitness, Debbie Reinbolt, she gives three ever-changing stories to the police. And in her last documented interview with the state police and the Paris police, she actually admits to participating in the murders, or she alleges she did. I don't think she did, but she talks about how she held Karen Rhodes down while the two men first stabbed Dyke to death, and then as she forcefully helped Karen down, the two men turned their attention on Karen and killed her. What stood out to me is she makes this confession at the Paris Police Department. Now, they already know she's mentally unstable. She's a history of alcoholism and drugs. She's got a violent criminal history. And they simply let her walk out of the Paris Police Department that night. She wasn't arrested. And she would only be charged later with concealment of a homicide after an uproar from the community. Then, in the case file, there it sat, a $2,500 payment to her for her services, for her testimony to convict Steidel and Whitlock. And that was a shock to me because, I will tell you, in my 25 years of being with the Illinois State Police, I never saw us pay a nickel to anyone that admitted to being a participant in a brutal and terrible murder. I mean, she was a murderess at this point, not an eyewitness. And that decision would have had to come all the way from Springfield for that type of a payment. $2,500 back in that day was a lot of money for us to pay to an informant or someone that testified.
So they think that in some way by outing this that you have benefited, but this is still a cold case, and you're trying to make this right.
It's still an unsolved homicide, yes, very much. And I still question all the motives that remain uninvestigated, and I question why.
I was just wondering, Michael, again going back to the initial investigation, with the process that would have been followed or should have been followed, and the red flags you think would have been there for those reviewers also, the supervisors and reviewers, do you think somewhere along the line that somebody should have picked up on this before it got to the point it did, that there were issues and problems with this case, or? I mean, should it have gone as far as it did without somebody picking up on it?
Well, I definitely think that the supervisor should have picked up, the immediate supervisor that were overseeing the investigation should have definitely picked up on this. I mean, obviously either they were being lied to by the case agent, or they weren't reading his reports, When I see some of their signatures on documents, I have to believe that they weren't remiss in that they were just equally as egregiously involved. I mean, one of the master sergeant's signatures was on the receipt for the $2,500 payment, and that was the supervisor. So,
and another question I have before we run out of time is, you initially, when you first got this, were given the assignment to review this case, and you got these couple of phone calls from guys, about, I'm not really a dirty cop, and don't make us look bad, and so on. When it probably became obvious to people in the department that you were, in fact, not just rubber stamping this, you were actually going to do and doing a review, did you get any more of those calls? I mean, did anybody else try to tell you to back off, or did they leave you alone?
Oh, I'd been called by other agents that were close friends and somewhat involved in the original investigation. And again, I got the same thing. Please don't ruin, Jack Eckerty's reputation. Again, only caused more suspicion. I got a lot of phone calls from the supervisor during the course of my review, and after I made my review known to the upper command of the state police, and trust me, I got MF'd quite a few times, and it wasn't an easy thing to do, and it wasn't a popular thing to do, especially, in the good old boy system that you can see sometimes south of I-80 in Illinois. But Michael, before we run out of time,
we're running out of time, and we want people to go get this book because it's a fascinating read about a struggle and a fight you're still taking on. Everybody needs to go to www.toopoliticallysensitive.com. The book is also available at Amazon.com. The author is Michael Callahan. To me, you're a hero, sir, and I thank you so much for being here with us. I mean, this has been what you have done for justice, for these two people that we all speak about. You're actually doing it. You're living it. I know there's other cases. I know that you're going to update the book, and we're going to keep the progress, but we want people to please go and get the book. Thank you to the CrimeWire team, our director of research, Kim Colton, and public relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be Tuesday, March 20th, 2012. Tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
And I want to concur with Susan, Michael. I also think you're a hero, and I do encourage the listeners to buy Too Politically Sensitive. It's something that needs to be read. And thank you all for joining us tonight in Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guests. If you would like your case to be featured on Crime Wire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. To hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show, go to www.crimewire.blogspot.com, turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play. Remember, we ensure that your voices will be heard when there is nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Susan Murphy Milano and Denny Griffin. Thank you very much, and good night.
Good night. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.